My name is Don DeBar. I live in metropolitan New York. I grew up here. I was pretty much spent most of my 71 years thus far here. I've been a journalist 20 years, maybe a little longer, mostly working in radio and some television. Also, more on television political commentary. I've been interested in politics and followed and studied politics and law and related history, philosophy, since I was a child, really. And I've particularly been watching international affairs and I don't know how you would put it in a way that would be meaningful for other people, but I've been interested in the shenanigans that go on around power in the global and national, even municipal scale. And so they kind of all work together to study, report on, and try to explain what happens, that the major things that have major impacts on people's lives, that create the context in which they live their lives, the legal framework, the political framework, social framework, you know, all of that, cultural framework. And I'm still doing it, and I enjoy it. And I think we're at a particularly momentous moment. I don't know what to... my friend, Professor Anthony Montero, says that we look like we are in a period going from one epoch to another. And I have to say that I agree with that, and I actually feel like a visceral sense of it sometimes watching things happen. We have a responsibility as people in the media to try to help people understand the world. And on the one hand, we have more tools to do that than ever. And on the other hand, we have less actual unmediated access to others than ever. The unmediated word there being key to the whole concept. And so we have a real struggle as the world seems to be in flux, both understanding it ourselves because our sources of information are almost entirely virtual at this point in our development, and the art of misrepresentation has it's reached probably its peak in development, certainly its peak over the historical precedence. And so, A, we can't trust the information that we've got. B, the people who convey it may well be intentionally misrepresenting it. And then the thing itself that we're explaining is, although it may resemble things that have come before, is a brand new critter, and so it's not something that can be exactly predicted how it's going to behave, or even thoroughly explained as to what it is without some further study. So that's kind of how I see what I got to do every day in that context. That. Big doings are going on out there. I got to try to look at them, figure them out, and explain it to as many people as I can in the hope that it'll help make their lives easier and sort of bring all of us closer to the levers of power that are the things that determine our lives.
Well, look, I mean, any journalist, any producer, any news editor has an approach to life, an attitude to their job. And somewhere on the scale between working for the public, doing what the public needs, looking out for the public, being public-spirited effectively, or else working for a special interest, their own selfish career promotion, somewhere on that scale they are. And it's certainly my experience is looking at the decisions being made by these news editors is that we're sliding back towards, well, you know, sort of, reset basically, which is for a lot of people would say, well, this is actually where human beings end up, is the selfish end, and you've got to work very hard in order to make sure that a system is public spirited and doing the public's job for them. I know when I was in 1989-90 in London working at the BBC for millions of listeners. Those listeners knew, listening to Greater London Radio with the DJs, the music and the news coverage, we were one of the best news coverage stations in the country. I think it's nobody would really disagree with that who listened to it at the time. That the listeners knew that we were working for them, and they knew that if anything was going on in London that they needed to know about, we would do our best to find it out. And we had the staff to do it, and we had that attitude, which was very independent-minded. Well, that's obviously changed massively in the decades since then. But trying to put all this into context, the technology we're working with, Don, particularly with broadcasting, and you know, film and radio, you know, originally radio in the 1920s and the film even before that, obviously, this is a relatively new technology, really. I mean, if you look at the history of mankind, we haven't had this ability to, you know, for moving pictures, for sound, to transmit it around the world, you know, long distances, really very long at all. It's a blink of an eye. So trying to put it into context, it seems to me I was just thinking about the 1960s and 50s there's some amazing films around. There's Pandora and the Flying Dutchman from the 1950s, a Hollywood film, and Dr. Strangelove. These sorts of things were being churned out. You know, there were some brilliant films coming out in the 1950s, 60s, 70s, really mind-blowing stuff. Humphrey Bogart, people like that, who would only play a film that they really loved themselves and knew was going to put them in a good light. Now we were in a situation where the actors and actresses, staff on films will work for any old, you know, they don't care really about that. What they're interested in is them on the screen, the fame that comes with it. So that's completely turned around. And I wonder whether we're at a stage where the mass media, whether it's films, television, whether it's radio or even newspapers, is kind of come full circle from the invention of these processes, particularly with broadcasting. And I mean, this, the effect on the global population is something as big as the atomic bomb. The idea that, you know, millions and billions of people can be watching something live on TV around the world. And the way that is framed is such an immense, such an immense trust. Seems to me, Don, the trust has been betrayed, you know, whereas it, maybe in, you know, when we were kids, in our generation, in the 1960s, 70s, people felt that this was something they could be safe, you know, with, and that you would get something which was at least reasonably balanced and independent. Nowadays, it's like the psycho in the corner. That's the way I describe it. But anyway, I wonder what you make of this modern phenomenon where millions of people, at an event like, say, the September the 11th attacks, can be given a certain impression about the way something that's happened, which may actually be nothing near the truth.
You know, it's interesting looking at the history of all of this, of radio and mass communications in general. On the one hand, various technological advances make it, they almost have a democratizing effect on the distribution of information. Whoever has a transmitter or a microphone or access to one can speak, and they may not be part of the official propaganda machine of the state. I'm using that not just for government, but for power in general, that term. Radio, you know, commercially viable, technologically speaking, radio, you know, appears in the early 20th century, maybe by the 1920s or thereabouts. It's, you know, you start to hear like a cacophony of voices on the air. Technical discord, I guess, or just the disorganization. People stepping on each other's signals and whatnot enable the federal government in the United States, the FCC, to establish the Federal Communications Commission, which in turn allowed for regulation, ostensibly for technical purposes, but there was immediately standards of behavior that would be tolerated, words that couldn't be said. Ideas that couldn't be communicated, through the mass media, even though this was available. For example, this is the first time in history that someone could get in front of a device and communicate to the members of the working class the ideas of Karl Marx and Frederick Engels and a host of others, and yet you could not do that. It was less likely that that would happen since these things enabling it came out than it was before they came out, because as this democratizing technology presents, power appropriates it and weaponizes it. And we've seen that happen with mass media from one technical crescendo to another. When we saw television, well, film, you had film. There was independent film first, and you end up with a film code where you can't even sit on a bed without your feet touching the ground. It's a pervasive censorship. In other words, television, likewise, the same thing. It ends up in the hands of these mega corporations who use it, in essence, to maintain their power. The internet is invented as a part of the military infrastructure from the Defense Advanced Research Projects Agency, DARPA. In fact, it was called DARPANET, the internet, at its beginning. When it is made available to the people find suddenly realize they can talk to each other all over the world at no cost and organize groups and do things together. Also, as they strung cable television wires across the United States, media activists who had been watching for the previous 60 or 70 years of the development of mass communications realized the streets they're stringing the wires on belong to the public, and they don't have an inherent right to string those wires. And so if you're going to be granted the right or a permit to string the wires, you have to pay the public for that. And they demanded that they pay, aside from paying fees to help provide services at the municipal and county level here, they would also provide a TV studio and staff and equipment to teach people how to use television and speak to each other. And we had a blossoming of what was known as public access television over a period from the mid-70s, I'd say, up until when the internet really kind of took over, the YouTube age or whatever. These things have sort of just operated under their, they all require, they're all capital intensive in terms of development, particularly beginning with television. Radio was not quite that, and film the same, although as they matured as in terms of developing audience, as they became known to the public, the technical abilities of those with money and access to resources, there was no comparison between looking at a film produced in Hollywood and looking at a film produced by Bob next door on his little 8mm. And the same thing happened with radio over time. So you end up where you have capital, in essence, controlling these various technologies. In essence, you have the people being having their reality mediated by capital. First, the portion of their reality that they spend listening to the radio. So if I'm awake from 6 in the morning until 10 at night, and I listen to the radio for 2 or 3 hours, well, then the balance of that time I'm spending in contact with the world, like face-to-face. Over time, some of that radio gets, in addition to that, gets aggregated with a couple of hours of television time, maybe over the course of a week, a couple of hours in a movie theater. And then as cable television and internet and all these things happen, we're at the point now where you see children who are being socialized through their telephone, 80-90% of their time and their contact is mediated. And I mean, you've seen this with the 2 or 3 kids sitting on a couch, none of them saying a word to each other. They're communicating through this device. Now, how big a hand, how heavy a hand does power have in that mediation? Well, I'll give you just one example, because we have all these algorithms that people talk about about how people get steered and squashed and all of this. But just in terms of raw computing power, one little example. Back 3, 4, 5 years ago, I started to digitize. I started to basically take. I did a lot of public access television, and I have a couple of thousand videotapes here in my house from the late 70s until 10 years ago, that all different meetings and interviews and et cetera. So I decided I was going to try to preserve as much of it as I could before I, you know, hurtle off this coil here. And I started capturing them into the computer and then uploading them to a variety of free, you know, platforms like YouTube, including YouTube, by the way. This one tape that I picked up was an hour and a half long VHS videotape. It was one of two cameras that I had brought to my friend's wedding that was took place outdoors in suburban New York. It was a wedding of people who worked at this radio station, WBAI, in New York City. Most of the people there knew each other through this radio station that we worked at. And that included having a DJ who was playing music, and he had a very extensive collection of all kinds of music. It was on a very large parcel of land, and the two cameras were situated about 150 feet away from each other. The one I had was trained on a chuppah, like a small altar or whatever, where the wedding ceremony was going to take place. And the other one was 200 feet away on the other end of the property, inside a tent, where they had music playing, people were dancing, and all of that was going on. So I turned my camera on and just let it run, waiting for the people to come show up and, you know, catch them walking into the area where the ceremony is going to take place, get the ceremony, and watch them meander out and all of that. I wanted to skip that live. And without hands on, I just let it run. So when I captured the tape, I remembered this. And for the bulk of it, it's nothing but a fixed shot of an empty set. And you hear off in the way background. You can't figure out what it is. It's indistinguishable from just the noise, a little pulsing or whatever. I took that tape, digitized it, and I uploaded it to YouTube. Hour and a half long tape. About 6 minutes after I uploaded it, and it, you know, it doesn't take long to upload it. 6 minutes after I uploaded it, I got 35 or 36 copyright hits from Google, from YouTube, listing all of the songs that it deciphered, it analyzed as I was uploading it, not in real time, but the actual data identified each song, identified the copyright holder of each song, notified them that this had been uploaded and that I had used it, informed me that I couldn't monetize it because it belonged to someone else. 35 or 36 of these inside, I don't know, 3 minutes, 4 minutes. Now, uploading to YouTube, there's 10,000, 15,000, 20,000 people per hour at a minimum, sometimes a lot more than that. And they have that much computer processing power just looking at YouTube videos. So if you imagine that somebody built a system where they could mediate human communications without intending to use that to their advantage, you know, good for you. But if you consider the possibility that that's why these things were developed and were basically dispersed around the planet, that people intend to use it so that they can monitor and intervene in human communication, well, then you can think about how bad are we off already right now.
Wow. Well, yes. So one of my correspondents, I remember, he lives on a canal boat, and he did a fantastic article a few years ago about all the dead bankers. It was a whole spate of so-called suicides, almost certainly a systematic murder of loads of this is around about 2017, 2018, I think it was. And he also did a little piece saying this is where Google for the last 2 days has been testing its war algorithm. And he noticed that several of his own personal websites, plus those that he worked on for other people that were anti-war, suddenly got no hits at all from Google. So if you had the website, you would notice it. But he did, because he keeps a very sharp eye on such things. And so over those couple of days, he started monitoring. He put in searches into Google himself. Found that Google was not finding the stuff that he was asking for on his own websites that he knew was there. And so this power is enormous. Of course, they don't know what we don't tell them. So anything that's omitted from these search results is not known about by the person who's doing the search, unless they're deliberately. You know what it reminds me of is back in the Soviet era, where people used to send postcards to themselves just to see if they were being intercepted, to see if it was going to be delayed by a day or never appear. And so that's what we're dealing with these algorithms. And there doesn't seem to be any kind of attempt to regulate this whatsoever. This is seen as a private commercial secret. We're also seeing the stealing of literally billions and billions of words of information by these AI companies. And recently, I think it was OpenAI, Sam Altman, who was grilled by Tucker Carlson, suggesting that maybe did you bump off that developer that was blowing the whistle, saying you were deliberately stealing millions and millions of possibly billions of dollars, pounds worth of people's copyright information to train your AI. So this is a murky world. The internet has seemed to have, it started off with this sort of dream of being a free, you know, the whole Usenet thing, which was taken up by Google and then shut down effectively, the old news groups, which I used to use back in the 1990s. So it's turned into this sort of tech giant's playground, it seems. And it's almost as if the promise of the NBC, ABC, BBC people from the 1960s and 70s and the golden age of television. We're also in a situation with the internet where we've now seen much of the best stuff from the internet go, and it's all now being mediated by the likes of Zuckerberg and Musk. And Musk, by the way, is a political figure. He was beamed over to London on Saturday at the Tommy Robinson's rally, where he was basically got loads of people who were disenfranchised, anti-migrant people, and he managed to hijack the main stage and turn it into an anti-Palestinian, pro-Israeli event, which, of course, a lot of the people who went along to the rally are not interested in any of that. They weren't interested in what was going on the stage. And so Musk appears here, beaming in with his, you know, smiling as he watches this pantomime go on the streets of London, which is pretending to be a political protest. Well, it is a political protest, but it is being hijacked. And while it's being hijacked, Elon Musk is stood there. So I wonder what, just maybe if we could draw a line under this little chit-chat. If you think that the internet has had its day, Don, like television had its day in the 1990s, around about 2000, much of the drama started to go, the balanced journalism, the independent journalism started to go around about 2000. Maybe the same's now happened to the internet.
Well, I remember Kurt Vonnegut wrote years ago, I don't remember which book, it was just a passage, really, but the image stuck with me. Earth was jazzed with electricity for a while, describing basically human evolution up to and including the modern age, and which lasts for a very short time, and then we're back to, you know, rolling rocks around and you know, trying to find some bison or whatever. The internet is here. It has evolved to both, you know, you've got the infrastructure itself, you know, the physical, informational, you know, programming and software, whatever, all that stuff that operates at the operating systems and the platforms and whatnot. Most of the equipment that houses most of the data is privately owned. The ownership of that data is in a state of flux still, but there's been a very strong movement. You know, property rights in the United States and in England, you know, in Britain and in a number of other European countries had. I mean, you can see a line of evolution, and there's some branches in it from Rome, and it's not really a lot of, there are a couple, but not a lot of big sea changes in terms of concept. Certainly, the idea of a public square of a public what do you call it? Public spaces. I forget the hell damn word is for it. has shrunken. You know, the public trust, the public domain that was considered mostly everything except for what the king and some rich guys owned, and then where, you know, the rest, everybody else was on public land, which, of course, since the king owned the public or some regent owned the public, they had that kind. Anyway, property rights have evolved, and this is an area of my expertise. I spent 50 years probably in the title insurance business here, which has land titles, ownership of real estate. The intellectual property rights, such as copyright and trademark and all of that, were at different points in time, whether different rapid changes of technology, you would see some accompanying changes in legal thinking and practice and in cases interpreting laws that, you know, were older but reinterpreting them to sort of accommodate to the new environment, whatever. But nothing like we've seen. You know, for example, the movie It's a Wonderful Life with Jimmy Stewart and Bedford Falls. They have, you know, that was in the public domain along with a lot of other stuff up until, I don't know, 5-10 years ago, and they suddenly are not. Some corporation owns them, and so you don't have access to these things. The reason I'm bringing this up is the internet was like a Wild West when it first was connected. People, if you had some technological skills or technician's skills, you could capture, record a record off the record that you bought at the store for $3 10 years ago, and put it on a website or send it around by email and mass distribute it. And no one could really do anything about it. And then Congress and everybody started having hearings because the owners of the, under the old paradigm, you know, were basically, and even the people who owned or thought they owned the copyrights to this old, to all this music, that they insisted that the manufacturers stop making this equipment that was accessible to the public unless they could safeguard against their property being converted to, you know, by members of the public and shared without them getting a piece of it. And there's ASCAP. I don't know if you're familiar with ASCAP or BMI or these different entities that for years, if I write a song, I have publishing rights to it, somebody records it, they have recording rights to it, then somebody plays it on the radio and they're selling advertising space on their radio show while they play my music. Well, I'm supposed to get paid. I'm not. This is mine. I own it, and I copyright it. You file with the, you know, government office, and the government says, "Yeah, you're the owner of this. The song itself, or this recording of the song, this, you know, performance of the song, whatever." After a time, and this was for copyright, also for patents, intellectual property, for inventions and whatever, you would have exclusive right to something that, you know, that you could go to court and enforce for a period of time, 7 years, 20 years, whatever, understanding that human innovation ultimately belongs to all of humanity. That because some guy invented the wheel 200,000 years ago, his heir shouldn't be sitting on top of half of the land on the planet while the rest of us have to bob offshore because we were born after this guy invented the wheel. And so after a period of time of getting to live off the fat of the land, the wheel now belongs to everybody. Next innovation, please. Well, they started undoing that stuff. And once they secured or began to secure control, they meaning I don't know who, power, capital. Once they began to secure absolute control, or pretty damn close to it, of the traffic on the internet by a variety of ways, they also began acquiring property rights and all these things. Now, the ironic part of it is that the very existence of Google, as one example, is entirely based on their providing information about stuff other people owned and or innovated and or did. They were nothing more than an index to what information was available on the internet. And so if I wrote a paper dissecting, I don't know, mice, for example, genetically, that detailed all these little things that were innovations, and even if I had copyrighted it or whatever I did, if I published it, Google could put it in somebody else's lap without paying me a dime all over the world, and to an extent unprecedented, almost geometrically. And as they began to acquire control of more and more things, they began to claim property and all of these things that belong to other people. And they began to favor this one as against that one for money. You understand, you can buy ranking at Google when it says sponsored on the top. And I don't think you're going to have to put that much longer. And I'm not sure everything that doesn't say sponsored isn't placed because of a fee either. But the control of what's, in essence, humanity's memory and humanity's conscious mind and then humanity's eyes and ears is concentrated in a way that was unimaginable even 20 or 30 years ago. I mean, okay, maybe Zamyatin imagined it, you know, 100 years ago, you know, or you know, Orwell or whomever. But and just in terms of, I mean, I marvel at driving in my car with a GPS. I make a turn. The GPS tells me to make a left turn and I go straight. I'm not 10 feet past that. And it's recalculating a route. It knows the names of all the streets. It knows where I am. It adjusts its estimate of my arrival based on how fast I'm going at the moment. And if it was doing that for me, I'd say, wow, that's remarkable. They could use that for a cruise missile, which is what they developed it for. But you got millions and millions of people all over the planet doing that, and this system is processing all of that too. This has never existed before. This entire infrastructure has never existed before, and now they're taking this step or have taken this step, and we're learning that they've taken the step of letting it operate itself in a lot of ways. A frightening level. Mm-hmm. Of
what you're describing is, it seems to me, is a way to prohibit innovation. If you're not going to get the reward, I mean, I can remember probably around about 2000, singer, songwriter Peter Gabriel saying exactly this, saying, well, look, you know, if we can no longer control, you know, this industry is going to die. And it basically has died for people who are musicians. They really, the only way as I know you are too, the only way to really make it these days is if you get yourself a massive concert tour, if you get picked up by one of the big distributors of online music downloads, that sort of thing. But the main thing is actually getting on a big stage in front of a big audience, then you can make a few bob. Other than that, you get some brilliant musicians around, but there is no system that rewards what they're doing in the way that things used to happen. So in a way, what it's doing is it's just saying, well, just forget this. This is just going to be a hobby for you, even if you're one of the best musicians in the world. You may as well just go and work down the local burger bar.
Yeah. You know, go downtown, wherever you are, with a pad, make a list of every shop that you see, what they do. Go home or just sit on a bench somewhere with your little handheld and go to Amazon and, you know, look at, okay, candy canes, strawberry cake, Fender for a 1956 Chevy, guitar, et cetera. Whatever it is that you see there, think about how many people are not going to any of these shops anymore. I mean, the whole political economy has changed. The whole economic infrastructure is based on what came before, and it's a child and a product of what came before. But it seems to be also like standing above it and not upon it. It's something very new, and yet there's this dialectical aspect to it in that what looks to me, I mean, for what I know, whatever the hell I know, it looks to me like they're using it at the end of the day when this is fully expressed, if that's allowed to happen, you're going to have an updated, technologically capable form of feudalism. Everything will be owned by a small group, small group of people, I guess, or I don't know, maybe the machines will own it, but yeah, a small group of people. The rest of us that are remain, we don't really have any control over resource allocation. We would be relying on the benevolence or beneficence of whoever is in charge of resource allocation. If they decide to manage the population from one to small, there are all these paranoid theories about what's happening, and yet it corresponds so closely to reality that it's difficult to dismiss them out of hand or even to dismiss them at all. But I know the potential is there for some really ugly developments, even beyond the kind of ugly developments we have now, where we're watching an actual Holocaust happen and nobody's lifting a finger about it. They're pointing fingers at each other, over stupid stuff. The kind of world that could come out of where we are now is one where life is absolutely worthless. No one will have any control at all. We used to hear back in the day about totalitarian Soviet Russia, but that because that system didn't work, they had to let farmers grow their own little plot, and that's what they made truck farms, stuff runs to the city and stuff with. They won't even have that. We won't even have the, quarter acre to grow tomatoes on or whatever. All of the resources are being concentrated in fewer and fewer hands. The power to govern that is actually owned by that power. I mean, we look at the government now, at the relationship of the government to wealth, finance, whatever. It's clear that power doesn't reside in the halls of government. I guess I have to put it that way. And so there's this, I don't know, I'm scared to death. I don't know what the hell is going to happen.
Well, obviously we're all muddled through. Quite how many survive it? I think probably people were thinking similar thoughts back in the early part of the Second World War, or maybe even in the 1930s, observing totalitarianism getting a hold in Europe. But anyway, I think it's we ought to maybe mention this Charlie Kirk guy, because I've never come across him, Don, in all of my whatever. I think he's been around pretty much for at least a decade doing his thing with the Turning Point movement. And it looks as if initially it was a Zionist-funded organisation, part of the Republican Party youth kind of youth movement, but he's fused in with the MAGA organisation and Donald Trump. But you know what? Looking through, the first thing I did when I heard he'd been killed was look through some of his old, you know, even just over the last few weeks, he was over in Britain. He was at the Oxford Union giving a talk. And I immediately started warming to the guy. He was clearly putting his case forcefully, but he was absolutely up for hearing these opposite views and taking them seriously and respectfully. So he was the sort of guy I felt safe listening to. He wasn't trying to, he wasn't like some sort of grifter. He seemed to be absolutely genuinely engaging with these basically Christian moral values. The sort of thing that I see disappearing in many ways to do not with migration, migrants and that sort of thing, but more to do with things like the abortion issues, which has become everybody, you know, it's just a normal thing now. Back, if you go back to the 1950s and 60s before that, it would never be a normal thing. And I'm not just being nostalgic about it. I think it is an important issue that every individual man and woman needs to take seriously. But he was putting it across, it seems to me, in a humane way. And you might not agree with the guy, but it was very difficult to get annoyed with him. Because even though only if you're the sort of person who's got a fixed point of view and you're simply not prepared to listen to anybody else. So anyway, he's being murdered. Where there are there's still a few questions about this guy, Tyler Robinson, who's supposed to have done this, the alleged killer. And he's linked to his boyfriend, who is a trans person. And also potentially on... these antidepressant drugs. We're not sure about these things, but he certainly looks like a bit of a loner. The police have said that he's not cooperating, so this implies to me immediately that there's some kind of motive there, maybe through online grooming, or maybe he's just trying to impress his boyfriend or somebody else who doesn't like didn't like Charlie Kirk. But the main thing, it seems to me, is that there is this acceptance now, and when I was in the mainstream press, it would never be allowed to literally call for people to be assassinated, call for people to be murdered. On Saturday, there was a film went out by Rebel News, which is aligned to Tommy Robinson, all over the country, which is calling for the assassination of the British Prime Minister. Now, in my day, that would be something for the police. The police, you know, if you're incitement to murder somebody, then you're going to have your collar felt. And literally, if you're a broadcaster, the police are going to be round. What was this thing you were transmitting about encouraging someone to be assassinated? But none of that seems to have happened at all in Britain. The police apparently are looking for the guy. But, I mean, there seems to be this kind of climate out there. It'd be nice to hear what you make of Kirk and, you know, what's happened with him and how important it is. But also about this climate that's out there where, you know, it's just literally hate speech, and it is hate speech, that is encouraging people. And by the way, before Donald Trump was the attempted assassination on him, it became clear that both David Attenborough, the BBC naturalist broadcaster, and David Aronovich, and a couple of others actually, who's a BBC, runs as a weekly series on, had called for the assassination, the killing of Donald Trump before that assassination. So this has become, it seems, the norm now, that you can hate people so much you're calling for them to be killed, and the police just look the other way.
Well, first, this has been brewing for a long time. I remember when JFK was killed, there was a big public discussion, a big debate over whether or not you could regulate, basically regulate speech by making an assassination threat, his words, I'm going to kill the president, illegal, because that was done. It became a federal offense to make a verbal threat against the life of the president of the United States. That was against, you know, longstanding law here, First Amendment. I didn't see any changes other than a tightening further and, you know, further abrogation of the First Amendment, such as the Patriot Act and, you know, things in that line. And yet, back in 2018, I think it was, 2017, when Trump first went as president to meet with President Putin in Russia, in Moscow, I think that's where they met, Charles Blow, I almost verbatim, you know, like, it was not subtle, okay, called for Trump to be assassinated. The New York Times, at the same time, in the same time frame, had on its bestseller list a fictional novel. At the center of it was this person's fantasy with killing Donald Trump. This was being peddled. So, all right, well, we described that we have this network of wires and silicon and whatever the hell else it is, pushing air around and imagery that helps portray a picture of and soundtrack of the world for millions and millions of people around the world on a daily basis. For many people now, it's the largest piece of time during their day, gathering input this way as opposed to interacting with actual people and in terms of getting information about public affairs, policy, you know, all the things that are, you know, fundamental to, you know, our, the context. Like 100% or more comes through these means. Very few people, if you go to in any kind of a government meeting, show up on the regular. Most of the time, if you go, you'll see the people there or they're on a particular issue of concern to them, and they're activists on that issue. But in terms of self-government, the very utterance of the word in the United States is laughable. The people do not govern themselves. You know, we are governed, and with very little to no input in that. The annual ritual of voting for one of two candidates who have been selected outside of the control of something like 85% of the voters, again, it's not self-government. So when you have a situation where people have to be motivated to do something or other because some change has to take place culturally, I don't know, even physically, and you get a lot of people that show up over here or something, in order to do that, the means of communicating these ideas are utilized. We got to rally people so that the government can have permission to attack Iraq and not worry about some kind of dissent or uprising at home. And so wall to wall, you have like after the September 11th plane events, you have every TV station, every radio station broadcasting the same broadcast, you know, soldier, country, duty, yada, 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 yada. They can wheel that out anytime they want. Okay, well, now you have a situation where the bulk of the citizenry, the bulk of the people, I won't use that distinction, the bulk of the people within a particular piece of geography they're scared to death. Their living situation is very tenuous. Many millions in the United States alone are, you know, weeks from being evicted or foreclosed or both from their homes And there are millions of homeless here, as an example that, yes, this can happen to you. Millions and hundred, maybe more million, no medical care, and no means to obtain it. And then for many of those and for those with medical care, massive public relations efforts, and God knows how the hell else they do it, to tell people that, well, forget medicine, you know, eat this herb and, you know, drink this tincture of oil, something or other, and it'll cure your cancer. Don't worry about chemotherapy that you can't afford. Oh, no, it's a mess. And so what happens? The people are desperate and they're scared. They're being fed. You either belong to the pro-Trump or the anti-Trump cohort, for example. You're either a Democrat or a Republican, for example. You're either a Christian white this or a black something that or whatever, for example. In other words, it's divided across the board, and all of the time the media is exciting differences and hostilities between every I mean, it's almost like there's a cohort for each and every Social Security number in this country. I am 07648-8746. I'm proud. We're the best of all of humanity. It's like that bad. And so every little thing that happens, you don't need to do an MK Ultra to get somebody to kill this guy when it's going to happen anyway. Whether they kill this guy, was this the night of long knives, and they were somebody who was utilizing the so-called MAGA movement, was afraid that he's a potential leader who will have power in his own hands, contrary to the power that's currently manipulating it. Maybe. Or what happens is all this chaotic crap that's a consequence of a crappy situation just occurs, and those who are in power are in a position to observe it and to take advantage of it and to manipulate the fallout and the interpretation of it by everybody else. So for me, it's like a fool's errand to try to figure a lot of the things out that people are working on, like, well, was it this group did that and signed this, and here's a check that shows this guy got paid to this. Yet all of that's fine, but without that, this would still be going on, because the fundamental problems are here, and that's the real source of the big problem. The people are in a desperate situation. They cannot be ruled in the old ways. The rulers cannot rule in the old ways, and they are ruling in a new way. And the power that the technology has afforded them is unprecedented, and perhaps even was inconceivable 100 years ago. Now, what do we do with that? I don't know. Who was this guy in that whole mix? Some guy. He had a bunch of people. He was influential. You got all kinds of people that are influential, you know. This is a dead one. Did you see his wife's speech, the little press conference that she threw?
Yeah.
That scared the hell out of me. Okay. But if you think about it in the big picture,
Well, hang on, Don. Why? Why did it scare you?
I'm looking at it like as a media product, right? She's standing in his office next to his empty chair. I mean, that's the one you saw, right? And she speaks about, I mean, and she's obviously, look, he should not have been killed. But let me be clear about that. And I don't get any joy out of it at all. Okay. And I don't begrudge her as a human being grieving for her husband, but watching that this was on Fox, like, over and over. Okay. You, no matter what I'd say or do, or you'd say or do, no matter how important it was to humanity, Fox ain't just going to put us on television. There's a purpose to it. She's saying some of it right, some of it scary to me. His work was very important, and then her delivery was also interesting anyway. And I am going to continue it. I will make sure that his work is accomplished or something. The whole thing to me, it just wasn't Lurleen Wallace. I don't know if you know who that is here. George Wallace was a southern governor of Alabama back in the 50s and 60s. He was a symbol of the old South, quote unquote, of racist southern politicians. Although, as a matter of fact, a lot of that was, you know, he was opportunism on his part. I mean, the whole thing was opportunism, of course, but it was opportunism on his part. He wasn't really as full of hate as he acted, because he stirred up hate and benefited from it. But he was the governor of Alabama. He stood in the doorway of school to prevent it from being desegregated, all this kind of stuff. Then he was looking towards the presidency, and all of a sudden he was term limited out. They changed the constitution in Alabama so that you could only be governor for two or three terms. I don't remember what it was, but he reached a limit. So what did he do? Lurleen Wallace, who no one had ever heard of, his wife, ran for governor. He stood next to her and said, I will be helping her govern the whole way. And she got elected. And she ran. She was governor for two terms, and then he ran for president. So Lurleen Wallace in American politics is, you know, basically governing by spousal proxy or whatever. That's what the term means, at least as us, the people.
Well, it sounds a bit feudal. Yeah, like you were saying.
Yeah, yeah, it is, exactly. Feudal as in feudalism, not feudal as in pointless. Or, right. Yeah.
Anyway, look, let's get down to Donald Trump's visit to Britain, because, I mean, I certainly sense since Putin's visit, and the way it went down, which was an amazing thing to see, these European leaders all flying over, almost like fawning over the great emperor. We've now got the British, people like Richard Kemp and Hamish de Bretton Gordon, military, ex-military, if you want to call them that, MI6 characters, doing everything they can to hate on Putin and Russia, and to keep this war in Ukraine going, even though militarily the Ukrainian army is pretty much crumbling. Right. And but I mean, it seems to me the Kissinger doctrine or something has kicked in the United States under Trump, where they're saying, well, actually, this is crazy. This is a new, very powerful nuclear armed country. Henry, when he was around, was whispering in people's ears, do not take on a nuclear armed state. And so it seems to be an important meeting, actually, that Trump comes over to the UK. I wonder whether you think that maybe the United States administration has grown a pair. And I'm not saying in any way that positively over what's going on in Gaza, but at least it may be less likely that Europe and the United States have some sort of nuclear exchange with the Russians. Because that's, I mean, that, to me, that is where it's gone beyond this, the whole sort of scare tactics and saber rattling. There have been specific attacks with these long range missiles during Biden last year in 24. And then now it looks as if that is starting to calm down a little bit with Trump. So anyway, the dynamics between Europe and the United States, it's like the United States was the little puppy dog of Europe for centuries. Obviously, there was a degree of independence. But now it looks as if, to me, as if the European powers the Americans have just about beginning to slip the leash.
Yeah. Well, first of all, the visit to Britain and all the symbolic, you know, the carriages and I don't give that any value. I don't understand the value in it. People discuss this and I'm glad they enjoyed discussing it. It's not something that I pay much attention to.
Well, I'll tell you what I think is its status. It's snobbiness. Status is all it's about, really.
Yeah, yeah. It's Hegel, Marx, but it's appearance, not essence, right? It's show. In another medium, I would use another term, but describes that. But what was it? There's a couple of things that are undeniable. And again, I'm speaking from, you know, inside a, like a whole virtual universe of information. So much of it, most of it, I have no idea what's actually happening. I mean, we can start with, is Trump really an actual rebel of one type or another among the ruling class or the people behind him, like some, you know, a group that's in, you know, in opposition to some other dominant group in the ruling class or not? Is this all a show for us out here to fight with each other over, to have a little hope, you know, for someone like me to make all kinds of sort of gymnastics intellectually or rhetorically to explain, well, yeah, Trump did drop that big bomb over here, but what he's doing is trying to find enough space so he can make peace over there, and he's got to deal with these guys, so he's got to let Israel go crazy over here, but he's trying to not have a nuclear war with Russia first, and so we got to prioritize. There's a whole bunch of stuff that, you know, I find myself having to get to the point where I have to decide what reality is long enough to decide what I think needs to be done, to decide what I can do to help move it along, or I'm going to be completely immersed in somebody else's cartoon. And so I'm looking at the stuff around Trump and assuming that there is some kind of a contradiction inside the ruling class that he is at or near the nexus of, and thinking to myself, the first thing you want to make sure you don't do is put Trump and Xi and Putin in the same room, or maybe even in the same city. Because if it really is that, the objective conditions with the rise of, you know, the multilateral world that's rising, the change in relations between Europe and the United States, you know, all of these different things in flux as it is, those who see Trump and Xi and Putin as the leaders of the next era might decide to decapitate that rising alternative by taking them out. I would have to consider that as a possibility if I were one of them or doing their security, for sure. So there's that. Then there is the actual all of the things that are and or came into place around the creation of the war in Ukraine, for example, and all these other conflicts. There were interests that sought the condition that now exists because they were going to profit, for example, arms dealers, you know, the arms manufacturers, selling. They need NATO because they're selling 5% or 2% or whatever the GDP of Europe worth of weapons to them every year, whatever the hell it is. You know, and so suddenly if there's no threat from Russia, the people of those countries might say, hey, why don't you buy us some milk with that money, you idiots? And so as you're trying to navigate whether or not to have a ceasefire even in Ukraine, you've got all these other interests at every level that you have to contend with. And then what exactly are the cohorts deep within the, you know, what they call the deep state, deep within the leadership of the ruling class, that how they shake out around this, and how are these individual major interests involved? You know, there's a lot to consider. I don't have like 99.9% of the data necessary to really consider it properly, but some people have this information. The people that are members, and if Trump is really an actor here, and not, I don't mean an actor in front of the TV cameras for our benefit, but an actual actor in shaping events and determining events, then, you know, he's got a whole lot of competing interests that are, they all play rough. They play full contact. They kill anybody. And Zelensky knows it. He can't make peace. He can't not make peace because either his own people are going to come drag him out and kill him, or the Nazis are going to kill him if he tries to, you know, there's, all of it is such a mess. And so I don't know. I don't know what Trump wants to do. I know what he has said he wants to do. The reason that I would have, I preferred him over the other candidates both times that he ran, and in the all three times that he ran, was because out of all of them, he's the only one that actually said, let alone forget what he intends. The others didn't even say, let's not have a war with Russia. It's a stupid idea to get into a war with somebody with nuclear weapons. The idea, by the way, let's not have a war because there's no reason to have a war. He even went there. Nobody, none of them say any of that. So that's what we're left to work with, though. I mean, that's all. That is pretty meager, to tell the truth.
Yeah, well, I know you're right. Yeah, so you're basically like, democracy is down to the least worst candidate that's being put forward. But the thing with Donald Trump is he's not in with this Bilderberger elite, which I like to follow. I find them, because you've got this nexus there of European aristocracy, you've got, you know, your Goldman Sachs, the senior people, you know, the backers of the Obama and Clinton election campaigns. You've got your oil companies, you've got your Rupert Murdoch's general manager in that little nexus, which was also started in the 1950s. And right for the first 20 years was chaired by a former SS officer, Prince Bernhard of the Netherlands. I mean, you know, this to me, this is, we're talking about status earlier, you know, this is status. This is, and in fact, I remember The Economist one Christmas, you know, I think it was in the maybe the late 1980s or 1990s, for their Christmas edition when the editor was off. They had a piece in there saying that. It was looking at all these different think tanks, and when you have been invited to the Bilderberg, you have arrived. So this is they used a bit of Latin, said ne plus ultra, nothing above this. So we've got the modern, it used to be a David Rockefeller thing, it's now a Peter Thiel thing. So it's gone from oil and banking to the new form of banking is digital money, and also, of course, social media, which Thiel funds, and accelerationism, which is this Thiel's philosophy, and amazing to see him last year doing this bizarre interview about the end of the world, the Book of Revelation, this sort of thing, you know, which to me, looking at him, it looked to me as if he was just trying to occupy that space. Because he knew that people thought that he was involved in perpetrating the end of the world as an accelerationist. So anyway, the point is that Trump is outside that circle. He's very much outside that circle. And I'm not even sure he wants to be in there. He's somebody who I think you could pretty much say is, with the help of the mafia, okay, he's his own, he says what he honestly does say what he thinks. And I rather like the humour that comes with it, even if it is dark humour, and even if it is sits alongside this horrific genocide that he's backing for whatever reason, probably blackmail. But anyway, I just like to round up by asking you about what you think of the relationship between Europe and America. I was hinting just now about the slipping of the leash, and I want, you know, because they have been absolutely aligned right the way through First World War, Second World War, you know. Up to till now, there's been this Euro-America block, power block in the world, very tight, what they call the special relationship. But it's clearly Trump is rubbing these people up the wrong way. Actually, I think it's the right way, because I think our European friends, the European Commission, Brussels, basically, NATO, the unelected European Commission, and the barely elected Labour government we've got in Britain, they don't like Trump. They really don't. It's quite obvious. And they don't like the fact that he's not going along with the Ukraine war. And they actually pretend to not like what he's doing in Palestine, although I think they probably do. But anyway, it just seems to me that there has been some genuine shift with Donald Trump. It may be it's only a blip with this relationship with Europe, Don.
Yeah, I mean, I think he's a product of the fact that things are shifting already. I don't mean him personally, but his candidacy, you know, his assessment that he could be elected, saying what he said and doing what he's done, because the conditions have changed. You know, whether evolutionary, revolutionary, whatever, you know, the aggregation of things over the passage of time, you have these, you know, sea changes in society. The relationship between the U.S. and Europe is, of course, this was indigenous. There were people that were indigenous to this place that lived here by the tens of millions. The Europeans came here and slaughtered them and stole it, in essence, as was done around the world by Europeans, particularly the UK, Spain, France, to a lesser degree, sort of the Netherlands and others. That was one of the big items in Hitler's complaint box when he was penning his little tome in the early 20s in his jail cell, was that all the colonies had been taken already. And there was nobody left for Germany to climb on top of.
I just got to chip in quickly, because we were just discussing last week how interesting it was that, you know, the colonization of, you know, in 1492 with Columbus and 1497 with John Cabot in North America. This happened after the European aristocracy realized it wasn't going to win against the Ottoman Empire and the Moors,
right.
And it wasn't going to win against the Russians. You know, so they had to go in the opposite direction.
So they did. It spawns an elite here that basically supplants the British elite, although it was comprised basically of members of the British elite, whether old or, you know, newly attuned here. And then the, you know, gradual development of things over time, the war with Britain, 1812, and on until the end of World War II, when Europe was in shambles, absolute shambles this time, and the U.S. was the only force on the planet, really, that had maintained its entire industrial base and turned around and said, okay, well, we'll redevelop it. And they continue to this day to occupy large parts of Europe, including Central Europe. They're still, the U.S. military is still occupying Germany, Italy. You know, these places have massive U.S. military bases. So, you know, the stuff that's in the papers and the stuff that they say in Parliament or in various, you know, legislative bodies across Europe, they're not exactly, I don't think they give proper due to the fact that these are countries that are militarily occupied still by the United States. You know, there are all kinds of advantages to the elite. First of all, the actual elite, capitalist, whatever, finance, elite, whoever it is that's in charge of the world now, I don't think that it's limited to any nationality. And this is one of the ways that you construct an empire, is you take in some of the top people in each of the colonies and incorporate them into the leadership, incorporate them into the ruling class. So I'm sure that old aristocracy, although they still have the lands and titles, some of them, and certainly are wealthy and have power locally, some of them are also cut in on the, I'm sure. I mean, I don't know. I've never been to a meeting of the College of the Ruling Class of Humanity. I don't know who the hell is in that room, but I know who everybody says and people say is one person to another. You know, the United States made policy for Europe and for a good part of Asia, succeeded to the becoming the colonial power for the colonies of, all these different places. We ended up taking over, in essence, colonies of most of the other European powers and those that were in the Western Hemisphere, with the exception of the British and Dutch. And in many ways, we still have control of those anyway. So what's happening now is just a refinement of it, I think. And I think Trump is operating in that confine. On the one hand, he's saying, you guys have your own army. On the other hand, he's got the military contractors and everybody here that are used to sucking the blood of Europe through the military, saying, okay, well, tell you what, you guys will keep NATO. You up your cut of your GDP that's going to be spent on NATO. So we're going to up our sales, basically, of our weapons to you guys, but you can do what you want with them. I think that's kind of the relationship in terms of the military that he's throwing out there.
He's doing something similar with AI too, isn't he? All these big Microsoft AI contracts apparently just suddenly popped up today being signed.
Yeah, there's a whole lot of stuff.
Okay, Don, if you could just wind up with your whereabouts, people can find you, etc.
Okay, so you can find me on Facebook. It's Don D. Barr, D as in David, O, N as in Nancy, D as in David, E, B as in Bob, A, R. Don D. Barr at Facebook. At Don DeBar, one word, on Twitter. On YouTube, Don DeBar. On Truth Social, the Trump Twitter, same. And if you Google my name, you'll see other stuff.
Okay, Don DeBar, thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you, Tony. Appreciate it. It's always a pleasure to speak with you.